Ladies and gentlemen, our final panel is going to cover the topic of conclusions and regional outlook. We've had three excellent panels today on the three countries that we've been looking at, and I'm sure all of us have lots of ideas in our minds, and as do our panelists, and their job is going to be to put all of this into a sort of a new context for us. And we're very fortunate to have a first-class panel, as all the other panels have been for this final session. We're going to begin with Dr. Eric Langer, who is the director of the Center for Latin American Studies and associate professor of history and core faculty at the Edmund Walsh School of Foreign Service, Center for Latin American Studies at Georgetown University. Eric received his Ph.D. and his M.A. from Stanford and his B.A. from the University of Washington. He's written a great deal about Bolivia. Following Eric's presentation, we have Jose Antonio Lucero, who is assistant professor at the Henry M. Jackson School of International Studies at the University of Washington. Also has focused very strongly on the Andean region and on ethnic politics in Peru, Ecuador, and Bolivia, received his Ph.D. from Princeton. And our third speaker is Dr. Raul Madrid, Professor Madrid is associate professor in the Department of Government at the University of Texas at Austin, author of major works on Latin American politics, on electoral systems, on ethnic politics, and on the emergence of ethno-populist parties in the region. We'll begin, as I said, with Dr. Langer, and then when we finish, we'll have time for your questions. Thank you very much. Eric.
Thank you very much, Peter. It's a pleasure being here, and thank you for inviting me. I also wanted to say that one of the reasons why I think I can talk about this is because I've had the privilege of speaking about once a quarter at the Foreign Service Institute about Andean indigenous movements. And so that's kept me fresh because I've had to keep up on this. And every time I do this, it seems like things change. And so I have to do things as well. And before I start, I just want to say, as you say in Bolivia, buen provecho, because I think that's very important at the end of a meal to do so. Feel free to get a coffee. Hope I can keep you awake anyway, but feel free to do that. Okay. I've been following indigenous movements for a long time, including actually having edited a book on this. And my original take on indigenous movements in the Andes, which, by the way, wasn't as applicable for Peru as elsewhere, was that they had reached their high point early in the 2000s. Maybe 1992 to 2003 was kind of their high point. And after that, they declined. And then, secondly, when they actually entered into government, se quemaban, as Javier Albo says, you know, because now they had to govern over all citizens, and they couldn't fulfill the ethnic or cultural demands of their constituents, and as a result, lost their base, as happened with Victor Hugo Cárdenas, for example, who was vice president under Goni in Bolivia. But nevertheless, that they still had veto power because they could mobilize against policies, not necessarily for policies, and that really did make a difference. And as a result, Lowell could justify the fact that he could invite me back to the FSI over and over again. However, the thing is that, in fact, my calculus has changed because now you have these neo-populist leaders, populist leaders as Correa and Morales, and they really jumbled this calculus. First of all, Correa's popularity and Pachacutec and Luis Macas's demise in the presidential election seemed to signal that, in fact, the indigenous movement was over, and that was the end of that. Also, obviously, Evo Morales, as new claim to being indigenous, he's actually not the first indigenous president of Bolivia. That was somebody Santa all the way Cruz. Back in 1829 to 39, Andrés de Santa Cruz, one of the best presidents Bolivia ever had, in which indigenous movements became his handmaidens, and the real participation really was in MAS and the Constitution, et cetera, et cetera. But in fact, that was the end of the indigenous movements co-opted by these neo-populists. Obviously, again, Peru doesn't really enter into all of this. However, it seems to me that there are new perspectives, and I had to rethink it again. And first of all is, of course, the massacre in Bagua in Peru in June 5th, 2009, which we've already talked about this morning, which shows that, in fact, these regional movements, in fact, might have quite a lot of life to them. And the place to look for indigenous movements in Peru isn't so much in the highlands, where, after all, the rondas campesinas and places have had an etnocaserismo had put on a very conservative kind of touch to all of this, but rather elsewhere. It seemed, you know, although Bagua was where indigenous peoples lost lives, actually I think more police lost lives, actually it's not quite clear who lost more. But be that as it may, I think it's really a rallying point, and it's a change in the relationship between indigenous peoples and Peru, particularly in the lowlands. I think in that sense it's really a victory for the indigenous movements, because now they have the concientización that they didn't have in really a major way, because this became major international news as well. And so, you know, this is really the first time that away from the army in the rondas campesinas, something has really happened in the case of Peru. And I think what this augurs is a new kind of movement in Peru, where indigenous issues, while they will still be in the minority in terms of the population, which they clearly are, will be extremely much more important than before. In the case of Ecuador, I was just in Ecuador a few weeks ago, and I was particularly interested in the indigenous movements. I think there is a tremendous change as well going on. First of all, the Ecuadorian government is being buffeted by recession. As you all know, populist leaders and recessions don't go together very well, because it really decreases the resources that the state has to give out. And this is happening here as well. And clearly, indigenous peoples have been organizing against, or beginning to organize against, price hikes. There was all the water legislation, etc. And what is interesting is that Correa, in fact, backed down over the water legislation when the negotiations began. And so I began asking, you know, how could this be if, in fact, Pachacutec is more or less dead, which I think it still is, at least on the national level. What some people told me is that, well, there is actually this whole other factor that you have to take into account, namely that CONAIE and the indigenous population has a very interesting relationship with the Ecuadorian military. And a very close one, in the sense that it's a symbiotic relationship in which the military attempts to keep Correa from messing and politicizing with the military. And the card that they hold is say, well, we'll just let loose the Indians if you don't, you know, if you start messing with us. And obviously I'm oversimplifying things, and, you know, we could talk for half an hour on this, but I think there's really something to this, where, in fact, there is this relationship between the indigenous movements and the military, where, in fact, again, Ecuador, rather than where Pachacutec was quemado, in this case, by working with Lucio Gutierrez, now again has effective veto power, but in this very uneasy alliance, but nevertheless real alliance with the military. And quite clearly, Correa is very leery of this, he, as a result, has backed off. I think the proof in this is on the water laws and things like that, and he will continue to back off on issues where the indigenous people, I think, are particularly interested in and are against what the developmentalist side of the Correa government. In the case of Bolivia, I think Evo Morales will win. At least I don't believe it. That's what the polls say, about 55% of the vote, and he might or might not get two-thirds in the Senate and in the lower chamber. And it's clear that his rivals don't really take into account indigenous peoples. So what it means is that indigenous peoples really have no choice rather than to stay with him, and they will clearly vote massively for him. At least, again, this is what the polls seem to tell us. But as you know, polls are least reliable in rural areas because they don't have telephones and things like that. But in this, I agree with Carlos Toranzo in that the more indigenous the government gets, the less power the indigenous have. And I know he didn't put it quite that way, but I think that's exactly what he implied. And the reason for that is multiple. One is that the new constitution, in fact, decentralizes power. And by creating 36 different ethnicities, of which the only really large one and relatively consolidated one is the Aymara ethnicity, all the others really fall by the wayside. And what it really does, it decentralizes power even more, leaving only really the Aymaras and the national government standing, and thus make it able for the national government to do things that otherwise they wouldn't be able to do. And in fact, here I also think that Morales is much more a sindicalista, a union leader, than an indigenous person. You can just see that from his career, though he has been very opportunistic in using the indigenous label, and this rhetoric has really been able to take over what used to be one of the most important indigenous movements, and they have become basically followers of Morales because they have no other option. And, of course, Morales has been very smart because, A, it's politically not kosher, it's politically incorrect to talk against indigenous people. So if you are a cruceño and then you believe in white people power, that doesn't sound so good. And in fact, in a sense, some of the people do that, and obviously that doesn't work. And so as a result, what Morales has really done with indigenismo is paint the opposition in a corner, but also paint the Indians in a corner as well, the indigenous peoples, because they really have nowhere else to go. There only seems to be one area where I think things might change, and that's in part why I asked myself the self-interested question earlier, and that is the gas industry. There you have a actually nascent and very long-standing indigenous group, the Aba Guarani, about whom I just wrote a book about, so a little bit of propaganda for my book as well, who, in fact, are the ones whose ancestral areas is where the gas industry is located. And so they, in fact, have not been very happy with government policies because, again, Morales is doing somewhat what Correa was doing, namely being developmentalist elsewhere, where it's in his favor, and as a result, he, in fact, wants to develop the gas industry even more. But what the Aba Guarani say, well, if you're going to do that, you have to pay us more as well, which, of course, doesn't go over well. Now, what will happen to that, we don't know, but clearly there are cracks, thus, in the kind of project, in addition to perhaps the contradictions that both Carlos and René talked about earlier. And in fact, the other thing is that the gas industry is located in Tarija being part of the Media Luna, in a very strong part, perhaps the strongest part of the Media Luna, that is against Evo Morales. So there's a whole number of different regional and ethnic dynamics here that might make things somewhat different. As a result, what I see as a whole, and with that I'm going to end, I don't want to, feel free to get some coffee if you are falling asleep at this point. In fact, things are a little bit more complicated, I think, as Robert was saying as well, than one might appear at first look. And thus, it seems to me that, in fact, the indigenous movements in certain areas might be much more important than we otherwise think, and that this is a story that hasn't been finished and will continue to be very important over many, many years. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Eric. Tony?
Thanks, Peter. Before I begin, I'd like to thank Peter DeShazo for the invitation, and also Taylor for all her work in getting us all here to Washington, D.C., and also thanks to the translators who heroically and silently somehow make sense of what we say in another language. I think I understand that because we get to talk about three countries, we have three times as long to talk. Peter, is that right, or did I misunderstand that?
You have to synthesize it in one-third the amount.
Okay, I misread that. Okay, so I will try, and then I will apologize to the translators because I'll be going through some of these slides fairly quickly. I will be drawing, though, on a paper that I'm working on for a volume edited by Todd Eisenstadt, my colleague at American University. So if anyone is interested in getting a more slowed down version of this argument, you can email me. I'll be happy to send you a draft of this paper. What I'm trying to get across here in this paper is looking at multiculturalism in a critical light. And there's a lot of controversy over terminology, and I don't want to get into that too much. By multiculturalism, I'm referring to the state-society dynamic that has put indigenous and Afro-Latin American issues on official governmental agendas. That's what I mean by multiculturalism. And in reflecting on it and in trying to bring together some of the ideas we've already discussed, I want to draw on the ideas of the great economist and philosopher Albert Hirschman. And I borrow the subtitle from his great book, The Rhetoric of Reaction, Perversity, Futility, and in Jeopardy, to organize many of the critiques that have been made of multicultural policies and of indigenous movements. For those of you who read the book, you know what Hirschman does. Basically, he takes a look at arguments against progressive reform starting from the French Revolution to the late 20th century to suggest there's a fairly predictable pattern to critiques of reform. There is the perversity idea that what you try to do will backfire and it'll produce the opposite outcome. There's the futility idea that it just simply won't work. Or there's the jeopardy idea that what you do to help one group of people or one set of issues will put others at risk. So those nifty little ideas will be shorthands for my organization of my thoughts about the what has been written so far about multicultural policies and indigenous movements. But before I do that, let me just give a I'll inevitably run out of time, so let me tell you what I was going to say. The futility idea, if you look at the literature, would suggest that many of the multicultural official policies have been symbolic or have crashed on the rocks of the lack of political will, that beautiful constitutions have not translated into effective policies. The perversity thesis has a couple of different variants, but one has been popularized in the idea that multiculturalism, rather than empowering indigenous movements, has actually been used as a way to co-opt them. A different version is that it's generated a backlash, creating less tolerant societies rather than more inclusive ones. And the third, looking at the idea, is that this has created new jeopardies. That there have been jeopardies for individual rights, there are jeopardies for women, for Afro-Latin Americans who've been marginalized, and the dangers for the economy in terms of what is done according to resources. I'm not endorsing any of these ideas. I'm just saying this is one way we can organize our thinking about it. My overall contention is that multiculturalism has yielded a host of uneven outcomes, which shouldn't surprise us because it depends on the constellation of political factors and that it happens in each country. The alliances that are struck, the permissiveness of certain governments, the intolerance of others, and the help of allies. So these kind of configurations have resulted in very different outcomes, as we've already seen throughout today. Very quickly, just so we know what we're talking about, and I think we all do, but borrowing the work of the late Donnelly Van Cott, there has been the emergence of more or less a regional multicultural model, which has involved the following elements. Some kind of formal recognition of ethnic difference, a recognition of indigenous customary law, some room for collective property rights, some kind of recognition or officialization of indigenous languages, along with self-government, autonomy, and then finally some enhanced representation or participation in governmental services. Now, as she looks at these different policies, she finds there's been great variation, stronger in some and weaker in others, depending on a host of different kinds of conjunctural possibilities. The countries that we're concerned about today for Donna were evidences of strong in the Bolivian and Ecuadorian case or modest to weak in the Peruvian case. And we'll continue to talk about that. One quick parenthesis, though, so you can stop the clock, Peter, while I say this, is the Peruvian case. One thing that is always my bee in my bonnet, and I've written with Marilena Garcia about this, is the question about the great Peruvian anomaly, the great Peruvian absence. One of the dangers in that is I think we've become enamored of our models of what indigenous movements should look like. Ecuador is a successful case, at least in the 1990s, but the idea that movements should be national, should be united, should be operate on these different levels, I think is a misleading one. There's no reason that grassroots organizations have to grow from local to national levels. I think to assume that they must is an analytical mistake, and I think it's maybe even a little bit of academic colonialism to impose these ideas on different indigenous realities. Okay, close the parentheses. Peter, you can start the clock again. Now let's go to futility. Very quickly, much has been said already. But I think in all three countries, what we can see is that even in cases where there's been advances in the 1990s, as was the case in Ecuador, there's been retrenchment. Ampam Caracas already mentioned this, as did Carmen in the case of Carmen Martinez in the case of Ecuador, where gains in terms of policymaking institutions, bilingual education, Correa has moved backwards. Interestingly enough, perhaps ironically, Evo has as well. One of his first measures as president was to abolish the Ministry of Indigenous Affairs. His argument is now there was an indigenous government, so there was no need for his own ministry. But what that did was undermine the policymaking power of the state in indigenous development issues, creating real problems for management of policy. Peru, it's not a surprise that Alan Garcia has been hostile to indigenous issues, but as we've already heard Oscar put it well, INDEPA has been almost disappeared, and the events of Bagua are clear evidence of the attitude of Alan Garcia. Evo Morales said that he liked Alan better the first time around when he was skinny and to the left, better than now where he's fat and on the right. That got him in trouble. But if there's one caution that I would make, and I think I've learned this from Ampam Caracas, is that we should also avoid thinking about indigenous politics as top-down. It doesn't only depend on the framework that is enshrined in constitutions. What happens locally, what happens in municipalities, what happens how indigenous people exercise their own rights with or without the permission of the state is incredibly important and often hasn't been analyzed as directly by political scientists like myself. Now, what about some of the first possibilities? The most famous version of this thesis was advanced by Charlie Hale, who suggested that multiculturalism menaces by creating a division between those radical indigenous subjects who want to make real redistributive demands and then the less radical, moderate indigenous subjects who are happy with cultural recognition, thus allowing the more dangerous radicals to be excluded and the more modest pragmatists to be co-opted. I think it's an interesting idea, and it's been used to great extent in much of the region. One of Donna's great contributions was to look at this and say it's actually been a lot more mixed, that multicultural policies in the 1990s, especially in places like Bolivia, did not eliminate radical possibilities from emerging, which is what I'll get to in a second. So that multiculturalism can have both transformative and conservative implications. It's not predetermined. But what it has produced is a very uneven set of trajectories across the Andean region. So very quickly, let me trace those arcs, really summarize what's already been said. I'm going to talk about each of these cases, but generally, I think we can say the Ecuadorian case was a case of a strong movement pushing things from the bottom up, pushing a multicultural agenda and halting a top-down neoliberal project. That more or less had an inflection point in 2000, where the movement, as has already been said, faced an internal crisis. Bolivia was somewhat of an opposite case, where the 1990s were a period where neoliberal multiculturalism from on high set the table, and indigenous movements found it difficult to navigate, and thus the election of Morales is a reversal of that kind of dynamic. Peru has been characterized more by an opening and closing of windows for indigenous agendas, more closing than opening, and I'll put a little bit more meat on those bones as I have time. As has already been said, the 1990s in Bolivia were a time of neoliberal multiculturalism, where there was an attempt to bring in CONAMAC, CIDOB, as more friendly to the kind of plans that Goni and Victor Hugo Cárdenas had for including folks into the regime. That, as we all know, did not last forever. Just a quick sketch of statistical of social conflicts from 85, the beginning of the kind of neoliberal period, to 2003, you see a steady increase in terms of conflicts over hydrocarbons, over mines, over coca, and this is these are the resource wars that we all know so well. And this was part of the undoing of that neoliberal multicultural moment. And again, this is something that I'll only summarize because I think we've already had a nice discussion of it. There was an implosion of that system, not only of neoliberalism, but of the partidocracia that had characterized Bolivian politics, where parties made decisions behind closed doors, and it was the Congress that really made the presidential decision, not the people. So that's there a lot has been made about the fact that Evo Morales won outright in the first round, and I think it is something to celebrate, even though there are clear problems with some of his government policies, as has already been said. Also, to return to a question that came up earlier today, the emergence or the return of some of these radical voices, as Felipe Quispe and Evo Morales here, was done with help from the United States in terms of neoliberal policies, which were seen as an imposition, coca eradication, which was coming also seen from the U.S., and also the help of a U.S. ambassador who, on the eve of elections, told the Bolivian people not to vote for Evo Morales, which was the best thing any U.S. ambassador has ever done for Evo Morales. Made him a real star overnight and moved us in this direction of what Nancy Postero calls post-multicultural Bolivia, where these targeted policies are no longer the agenda, but a more eclectic, indigenous, popular idea, which we've already heard a lot about. Ecuador, as I said, is the mirror image. The 1990s were the decade of the levantamientos, the década ganada, as Luis Macas said, where indigenous nationalities, indigenous peoples could stop the plans and ideas of neoliberals like Jimmy Mawad. That led to many conflicts. Just another quick look, you can see the first indigenous uprising, the fall of Bucaram, the fall of Mawad. All those were important victories for the indigenous movement, but that last spike, the fall of Gutierrez, was an interesting point, an interesting moment for social movements, but it was also a low point for indigenous participation. The indigenous movement did not come to that party. It was more a middle class, more of a student operation, and they were burned by their association with Gutierrez, as has already been mentioned. And that really, the legacy of that moment is still one that I think the indigenous movement has not recovered from. And the fruits of some of that movement, the gains in policy of PRODEPIN, of CODEMPE, were used against the movement, as Gutierrez and later Correa were able to use some of these governmental spaces either to give them to non-CONAI actors or to reduce them as what has happened. So from the crisis and division of the Gutierrez period, we are now in the period of Rafael Correa, where the indigenous voice is very muted. So this is a real reversal of fortune. In Bolivia, and I think generally we can also say that there's been the risk of a backlash to some of that multicultural energy in indigenous politics. And to René Mayorga's very provocative idea that social movements seem to be on decline in Bolivia, I'm not sure if I would reach the same conclusion. I think indigenous movements are having to be more backstage actors than before. But it's interesting how the Media Luna has borrowed much of the repertoire of the indigenous movement. I'm talking about autonomy in the performances, they are very social movement-like in their performance. So there is an interesting kind of phenomenon going on right now about social movements coming from the right and coming from the rich. So it's something we can discuss more. To speak briefly about Peru, which is a very complicated case, so I won't do it justice, and I would agree with everything that the Peruvian panelists shared with us. One moment just to note, the Comisión de la Verdad, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, was a very important opportunity, because in the war between the Shining Path and other leftist guerrillas and the state, over 70,000 people lost their lives. Two-thirds of them were indigenous people. So this was a public opportunity to discuss that, to talk about the legacies of colonialism that had produced that kinds of violence, and to really make this indigenous people visible to the country. In a way, though, that window of opportunity closed very quickly. Of the 12 commissioners on that important body, you can guess how many were indigenous. Not one. Not a single person on the commission, Truth Commission, was indigenous. It's like the TRC in South Africa without Bishop Tutu. I mean, it's inconceivable in the African context, but it wasn't in the Peruvian context. There was very little political will from Toledo, and much less from Garcia, who was implicated himself in the report. Now, the 2006 election that has already been mentioned between Garcia and Humala was an interesting moment, but it was not. It was not a good one for indigenous politics. The election atmosphere was very racialized. Humala is not a representative of the indigenous movement. In fact, he comes closer from their opposite. You know, he's from the military. He's more of an old school kind of military populist. He was lumped in the same sack with Evo, with Chavez, with all the kind of dangerous others that that people were afraid of. So the subtext of much of the Garcia campaign and others on the right was, vote for Alan Garcia. He's the only one who'll keep you from being killed in your sleep by your servants. You know, it wasn't quite that explicit, but there was a racial tone to the election. And the Baguazo was a clear culmination of that event. I have a 1 minute clip of a spot. I don't know, Peter, how I'm doing on time, but 2 minutes? Okay. We'll skip that. But if you look on YouTube, if you just Google Spot Bagua Alan Garcia, there is the commercial that the government ran talking about the indigenous movement as extremist. It almost calls them terrorist, and it's a spot about civilization and barbarism. The interesting thing about that effort was the reaction to it. Middle-class Lima rejected it. There was a huge mobilization in Lima itself against the government in favor of people were saying todos somos pisango, which was an interesting moment and possibly another window of opportunity that remains to be seen. Now, to move very quickly into the ideas of the problems or the risks for others, one of the more popular critiques in the literature is that multiculturalism and indigenous politics are troublesome for privileging group rights, for institutionalizing these kind of patterns of male leadership, especially in the communities, and for the lack of indigenous participation. I think those are important issues. Those are things that should be discussed and debated, but I think that we should also touch these with some caution. There's this, I think, a dangerous false choice that says you can either have your rights as an indigenous person or as a woman. And I think indigenous women are the first to reject that kind of decision. And they are themselves looking for their own third spaces of politics where they can create different ideas of indigenous feminism. The other point to raise is that liberalism has not been a walk in the park for women either. So we should not glorify these kind of liberal periods as being good for indigenous people, for women, because they are clearly were not. And the point is to think more creatively about alternative spaces. Another interesting critique has been raised about Afro-Latin Americans, how they are often marginalized in these multicultural policies. Juliet Hooker at the University of Texas has done some wonderful work on this, and you can hear it in the testimonies of some indigenous leaders. In one interview I did in Peru, the indigenous leader put it this way. We, the indigenous people of the Peruvian Amazon, are a nation. We have identity, we have culture. The Andean peoples have been a nation, have had identity, have had language and culture. The black peoples are not a people, do not have identity, and do not have language or culture. So this, there's one of the things, one of the dangers that Juliet Hooker identifies is the language of multiculturalism has been based largely on an indigenous experience and has not been reflecting the complexities of Afro-Latin American realities, which have their own characteristics. The Afro is often an afterthought, is the way the critique goes. And it confuses different locations in what Peter Wade calls a structure of alterity. Since the colonial period, indigenous people and Afro-Latin Americans have occupied different spaces in society. We shouldn't assume that all others are equally other, that there's different locations in social hierarchies. But at the same time, I think we should also be cautious with this critique because it's not always a zero-sum game. There are alliances that have happened in all three countries between Afro peoples and indigenous peoples, and even some truly interesting combinations of both indigenous and Afros, as is the case of the Garifuna in Central America, that reclaim their identity as an Afro-indigenous people, rejecting black and indigenous as separate categories. So, as always, the world is more complicated. Now, the final jeopardy, and before I conclude, it has already been mentioned, and this is the idea about resources. This is just a quick map showing the hydrocarbon concessions throughout the Amazonian region in all three countries. Most of the Peruvian selva has already been concessioned off. Garcia famously put in an editorial calling indigenous people the dog of the manger. They don't eat, and they don't let others eat. Which is understandable from Garcia, knowing what Garcia does, but perhaps it might be more surprising to hear that Evel says something almost very identical. He, in response to some Guarani critiques of extractive industry, he says, what then is Bolivia going to live off of? As some NGO says, Amazonia without oil. So one of the interesting ironies across these three countries, despite their differences, is the reliance on extractive industry as an engine for development plans. There, Peru is clearly more welcoming foreign direct investment, while Bolivia wants the state to have a stronger grip on the steering wheel. But the effect locally is remarkably similar across the three cases. So to conclude, just a few ideas to leave you with. One is we should not homogenize multiculturalisms or indigenous movements. There are different constellations of factors that result in very different outcomes. The second is, I think, even though much has been made about what Silvio Rivera called el indio permitido, about being an indigenous in the appropriate, the acceptable ways, there are bridges between indios permitidos and indios rebeldes. These are not prison cells, and there's been a lot of maneuvering that indigenous people themselves make to negotiate different political realities. And thirdly, I think we should maybe move away from these national-level analyses and really descend down in scale to look at what's happening on locally in municipalities, on the local level, to understand the dynamics of indigenous politics in more fine-tuned ways, and looking how they're responding to things like the challenges of extractive industry. And finally, I think what we're seeing here is nothing less than the decolonization of democracy, which often is not a very pretty thing. In fact, I was speaking with David Scott Palmer a second ago, and I was recalling a famous line in Fanon's Wretched of the Earth, in which African leaders come together at one point. One says, "We have earned the right to govern ourselves badly." There have been many mistakes by the Evo Morales administration and many mistakes by indigenous people, but at the same time, there's been a wholesale change of elites in these countries. There's been a change in what Arjuna Potter calls the capacity to aspire, the idea that these kinds of ceilings that neocolonial structures limited are now coming undone. And that's something that I think will take a long time to see how it plays out. So with that, I'll thank you.
Thank you very much, Raul.
Okay. First of all, I would like to thank Peter and CSIS for sponsoring this conference. I think it's brought together a great group of people, and I've really enjoyed the conference so far anyway. that's right. I'd also like to thank Taylor, who I haven't met yet, but my wife has the same job as you, but in Austin, and so she would kill me if I didn't thank the person responsible for actually organizing the conference, doing most of the work. Okay, so I'm going to be focused today on really the participation of the indigenous movement in electoral politics. And, you know, as we've already seen, there's been varying paths. So in Bolivia, the MAS has grown steadily, become a dominant party. Pachakutik, meanwhile, has declined over time. It initially fared relatively well in elections. It's now become a semi-marginal force in Ecuador. And no significant party based in the indigenous movement has emerged in Peru. So what explains these contrasting trends? Well, there's a number of different factors. One, I think ethnic organization plays a big role. Donna Van Cott emphasized this factor to a large extent. I think she was essentially right. I think ethnic organization has been more favorable to the emergence of indigenous parties in Bolivia and Ecuador than in Peru. Bolivian and Ecuadorian indigenous organizations, here I said, are relatively strong. Perhaps I should have said were relatively strong and unified at the time the indigenous-based parties were formed, and certainly relative to their counterparts in Peru. And I think this played an important role. Certainly there are currently divisions within the indigenous movements in both countries. There have been actually for a long time, but relative to Peru, they're relatively strong and relatively unified, and certainly were. Peru, meanwhile, does have relatively strong indigenous federations in the sparsely populated Amazon, notably AYDESEP. However, the highlands organizations are relatively weak and highly fragmented. And traditionally, the highlands organizations have not emphasized ethnicity. So there have been peasant federations in the highlands, but they traditionally did not emphasize ethnic issues at all. And they, by the 1990s, they were pretty weak, pretty fragmented. As a result, these organizations lack the legitimacy, the resources, the activists necessary to create and sustain a national party. I mean, any national party that's based in the indigenous movement, would really need a strong indigenous movement in the highlands because that's where the majority of indigenous voters are concentrated. Okay, and so we don't have that sort of indigenous organization in the highlands of Peru, and that has been a problem for them. Ethnic demographics also play a role. Here, though, by far the most favorable demographics are in Bolivia. Peru is actually more favorable than Ecuador here. So according to the most recent census, about half of the Bolivian population speaks an indigenous language. Okay, and here... Here again, it'll depend exactly how you count, whether you're just counting maternal language or any language, speaking some indigenous language is about half the population. Meanwhile, in Peru, according to the most recent censuses, less than 20% of Peruvians and less than 5% of Ecuadorians are indigenous language speakers. Okay, so certainly by that measure, the indigenous population is much larger in Bolivia than in Peru or Ecuador. Now, ethnic self-identification data, as a few people alluded to, is much more complicated. Here, it really depends. The numbers you get will depend on how you phrase the question. Okay, so in the much criticized Bolivian census, they didn't include mestizo as a choice. Only you could choose between five different indigenous categories, or you could pick none of the above. Not surprisingly, about 70% of the population, 63% of the population, picked one of the indigenous categories. if you phrase the question differently and ask, well, are you indigenous, mestizo, white, or something else, then you typically get less than 20% of the population self-identifying as indigenous, because that's not a term most people of indigenous descent, even people who speak indigenous languages in Bolivia, are not comfortable with. And the same is true in Peru and in Bolivia. So in Peru, they actually, I think, did a better job in the most recent census of phrasing the question. So where they included mestizo, as well as white as in black, as a category. But rather than including indigenous, rather than putting indigenous, they put, you know, do you self-identify as Quechua or Aymara, et cetera. Because in general, people of indigenous descent, people who speak indigenous languages, are more likely to identify with an ethno-linguistic group than they are with an ethno-linguistic category than they are as indigenous or Indian. Okay. In any event, no matter what measures you use, if you use them consistently, all of the measures suggest that the proportion of indigenous identifiers is higher in Bolivia than in Peru or Ecuador. And this has helped sustain a strong indigenous-based party in Bolivia. But, you know, as I'll be talking about in a second, it really depends on what sorts of ethnic appeals you launch, because people have mixed identities and mixed senses of mixed ethnic allegiances, strong sort of ethno-nationalist appeals would actually alienate voters. All right, so that brings me to the third important factor that I think plays a role in all of this, which is political strategies. I argue that the MAS over time has adopted a much more effective political strategy than Pachakutik. So Pachakutik started out with an inclusive alliance-based strategy. So, for example, in the initial elections, it did not propose a candidate from within the indigenous movement. Rather, it supported white mestizo candidates from outside of the indigenous movement. So Freddy Ehlers in 96 and 98, Lucio Gutierrez in 2002, and this was fairly successful. Even more, even within Pachakutik, this was a multi-ethnic movement from the beginning. This is include all sorts of urban-based organizations and all sorts of mestizo leaders within Pachakutik. Yes, it had a lot of indigenous leaders too, but it was not mono-ethnic by any means. And so this, I argue, helped it fare well in elections between 96 and 2002. In fact, Pachakutik fared quite well in urban areas. Most of its votes came from urban areas, urban mestizo areas. However, in the run-up to 2006, Pachakutik turned inward, lost the support of white and mestizo leaders and voters. A lot of them, a lot of the most prominent mestizo leaders within Pachakutik, left the party. Of course, as we talked about earlier, Pachakutik decided not to ally with Correa in 2006. Instead, it put forward its own candidate, Luis Macas, who was an indigenous leader. And none of that, as a result of that, they lost mestizo leaders and voters, and they even lost a fair number of indigenous supporters as well. The MAS, meanwhile, goes in the opposite direction. So the MAS starts out as an organization based among rural indigenous language speakers, rural Cochabamba. Okay, it does not start out as sort of a broad organization. It does not start out with extensive urban alliances, etc. But in the run-up to 2002, it begins to change. It pursues a whole series of alliances with mestizo white leaders, with urban organizations, etc., various middle-class groups. And all of this is relatively successful and helps the MAS win support in urban and mestizo areas. And you see a continued sort of shift in the mass between 2002 and 2006. So, for example, if you examine the plan de gobierno of the mass in 2002 and 2006, in 2002 it's actually much more ethnic than it is in 2006. There's much more discussion of, you know, Pachamama and various indigenous symbols. In any event, I argue that these sort of this effort to reach outward, to recruit a lot of non-indigenous candidates, et cetera, form alliances, help the MAS win support in urban and mestizo areas. All right, so what impact have the indigenous parties and movements had? Well, certainly they have improved indigenous representation in the legislature and governmental institutions. There was a time when you simply did not see indigenous people in the legislatures of these countries, or very few of them. Basically none at all, for example, in Ecuador and Peru in the 1980s, and only a few in Bolivia. Well, that's changed. Now you do see indigenous people in these institutions. Indigenous parties also have helped improve voter turnout in indigenous areas. This has risen, particularly in certain elections. Satisfaction with democracy, according to recent surveys, has also gone up among indigenous language speakers, for example. In Bolivia. Many indigenous demands have, in fact, become law. Okay. So they have had an impact, I would argue. However, many of these laws are certainly better on paper than in practice. Much of these things have not been extensively implemented. Agrarian reform is an example. But a lot of these laws are more symbolic at this point. Moreover, political and regional polarization has certainly increased in Bolivia under the MAS. And I would argue that the MAS has really moved much more. They've gone the furthest in terms of political concentration. So the MAS, in many ways, is a traditional populist party. It's concentrating power within itself. So the most extensive measures it has done is to concentrate political power within the party. The second most extensive, I would argue, is in the economic sphere, where it has made some changes. I think the least significant changes so far, where the changes have been most symbolic so far, has been in the social realm. And of course, this has prompted a backlash. Things are certainly tense in Bolivia. So these movements and parties have certainly brought problems as well. Well, what is the outlook for indigenous politics in the Andes? Well, I think it seems to be the consensus here, and I share that. Certainly, in the short term, the MAS will probably continue to dominate. Okay. That said, you know, the MAS being a populist party is heavily dependent upon its leader. And Evo Morales has concentrated power within himself a great deal. And so a lot of this depends on what happens to Evo. I think the MAS does have a hardcore base of support of maybe a third of the electorate. But in order to get that majority, it has to recruit this other 20% or so of the populace of the electorate. And that will depend on a lot of factors. So potentially I could see tensions between the MAS's sort of ethnic and populist constituencies emerging over time. They're dependent on Evo, Evo's continued presence. They're dependent on the MAS's ability to generate economic growth, to redistribute, you know, to engage in social spending, et cetera. And if the economy runs into serious problems or Evo is unable to engage in the sort of social spending programs that he's engaged in so far, the MAS could certainly encounter problems. But I view those as more likely in the long term than the short term. In Peru, I'm pretty skeptical of the idea that an indigenous-based party will emerge, I think. I think the conditions are not right at this point. The sort of organizational prerequisites, I think, are not likely to take place. And so I think it's really pretty unlikely to take place in the short term. That said, I think populist leaders in Peru for the last couple of decades have been using ethnic appeals to mobilize indigenous voters and to win their support. Humala did it, Toledo did it, Fujimori did it, and I think this trend will continue to happen. So I view it much more like in the next election that a leader who is not based in the indigenous movement, but perhaps, you know, like Toledo or Humala, has some indigenous features, is more likely to get the indigenous vote. All right. Finally, in Ecuador, I think Pachakutik is unlikely to regain its former influence. I think the strategy it pursued has done pretty serious harm to the party. Nevertheless, you know, it does retain the allegiance of some organizations. It will continue, you know, to win some votes in indigenous areas and to present some symbolic opposition to Correa on certain key issues affecting the indigenous populations. So I will stop there, and things open.
Thank you very much. We have time for a round of questions. The floor is open. Rob, why don't we do as we've done before, collect the questions and then ask the panel to respond to them.
So this is just a quick question for Jose Antonio. Thinking about the useful laying out of different multicultural strategies and their implementation in Latin America and the Andes, I'm wondering if there isn't a way, an additional way of thinking about this, departing from the, I mean, I know it was schematic, but, you know, departing from the kind of top-down versus bottom-up notions, in at least the Bolivian experience, one of the things that's notable is the way that, despite Silvio Rivera in the Indio Permitido notion, that legal spaces created from above lead to unanticipated consequences of exploitation in ways not necessarily in keeping with what was intended, and, in fact, incentivizing often unintentionally indigenous mobilization, identity formation in places where previously we wouldn't have thought to expect it or, you know, in unusual ways. And so it's a sort of a hybrid combination. It's top-down, but there's severe limits in some respects, despite, you know, the Charlie Hales of the world, I think, to how that's all going to go. And at least in Bolivia, it's been a productive, fruitful part of the heady mixture that led to what we have now.
Oscar.
More than a question, it's an example about something José Antonio Lucero said about these spaces that are open from below by indigenous governments, indigenous leaders in local governments. There's one experience this year in Datem del Marañón, which is the newest province in Peru. It's a province in Loreto, which is 98% indigenous population. And the mayor, Emir Masencay, an Awajun leader, has issued an ordenanza, which is a provincial law, that allows for the constitution of ethnic traditional territories, which Peruvian law does not recognize. But because there's this ILO Convention 169, it has a character of law in Peru, it has used that to approve this ordenanza. And, well, it's very recent thing, but it's going to probably become an example of these cracks that open between national legislation and regional legislation, where indigenous activists with some creativity, ingenuity, can use these cracks open.
Yo quería hacer una pregunta a los tres panelistas. Ustedes consideran, siempre nos han explicado que el MAS no es exclusivo de con los indígenas, sino mineros, o sea, cocaleros. ¿Es indígena? ¿Se le podría decir el MAS, el movimiento MAS, como indígena? El Pachacuti, si bien es una representación para los indígenas, pero era para construir el Estado plurinacional para todos los... ¿Se podría decir exclusivamente indígena? Y una última es... siempre varios analistas bolivianos decían que estaban en el gobierno, que estamos en el gobierno, pero no en el poder. Es ahora que van con el 55% que están pronosticando, ¿tendrán el poder? Gracias.
This is a question. Anybody can pick it up. But I'd like to take off on Eric's remark that indigenous voters commenting that we don't have anybody else to vote for. You can phrase that another way and says we finally have somebody to vote for. Because in past elections, indigenous vote was very divided among a lot of different political parties, manipulated with all kinds of patterns of clientelism and so forth, and they didn't sense there was one person they could rally around and so forth. I guess my question also behind that is related to what Scott Palmer related earlier about this notion of self-respect and prove and respect for the people coming from the government and prove there's no sense that this is coming in these recent negotiations and so forth. In Bolivia, we might have an excessive respect for the indigenous peoples, and that may account for this huge block of voters. You look at the rural sector in Bolivia, and there's no precedence for what Evo Morales has been getting from rural voters. And I think part of that, what you hear, you don't see the land reform benefits that Rene talked about. But what you hear is, he's one of us, he is us, in a sort of, it's a roundabout way of saying that's giving us more self-respect. And I'm wondering, what does that count for in this dynamic, and also listing of those achievements of the Bolivian experience in democracy and so forth, and the other indigenous movements. You mentioned strengthening democracy, but I'm wondering what this whole self-respect, autoestima, identification with a head of state, what's the value of that in this democratic development we're talking about?
Fabiola Cordova with the National Endowment for Democracy. I wanted to piggyback on that question because I was also struck by this idea there's nobody else to vote for, and actually there are other indigenous candidates that indigenous could vote for, but they're not real options. And I kind of would like to explore a little bit of this question. And there's been a little bit of character assassination almost against some of the indigenous candidates like Cárdenas. When we were in Bolivia in March, you know, his wife was hit and his house was taken over by the indigenous community. So I don't know, I think there's a little bit there that needs to be explored a little bit more of why, although we all agree that the indigenous movement is not monolithic, why isn't there an opportunity for other indigenous leaders to emerge from this very diverse movement?
Thank you very much. Why don't we go in the order that we went in, and the panelists may feel free to address any of the issues they wish.
Okay. The question is, is si el MAS es indígena? Yo creo que no. Y nunca lo fue, excepto que ha podido utilizar a los indígenas, amarrar a los indígenas al MAS. Pero hasta cuando se fundó, en realidad, a mí me parece así, no estoy de acuerdo con lo que dice Raúl, que en realidad el MAS nunca fue realmente un partido indígena, porque hasta la cúpula en realidad... no es de los indígenas. Hay unos pocos, pero en realidad no son los más importantes en ese sentido. On the indigenous move back to English here, on the indigenous movements, if there's nobody else to vote for, the reason why I asserted that is because the major candidates, other than AWOL, aren't even looking for the indigenous vote. And in that sense, I think, the one thing is that's really interesting. Carlos Mesa, actually a long time ago when he was still vice president, told me, this is a new era. We have now indigenous people in Congress and things like that, and that this is a very important turning point in Bolivian history. But on the other hand, what is interesting is that the opposition to Morales has defined itself as not being indigenous and not appealing to indigenous. And in fact, what's interesting is that if somebody like Victor Urrutia, to talk about your question, appears then as possibly somebody who'll take away votes, that's when the Masista mob comes in there and goes in there and takes over the house, wants to make it a library. Of course, this is in an Aymara area where you have the Puntos Rojos and people like that who are in alliance with everyone, actually somewhat uneven, very kind of uneven and not very, I think, natural alliance. But in any case, they basically did the dirty work and thus eliminated Victor Hugo because he's not running, though I'm not sure if he'd had much, you know, much possibility of winning this time around. So in fact, in the end, what you have is you have Evo Morales, who has, as everybody has asserted, really the indigenous vote sewn up. That means they have about a third of the vote, because that's about how many people are indigenous, according to my calculus, maybe a little bit more, 40%. Then you know, he can fight for the rest, and of course he gets the popular urban organizations, etc. So what does that leave? That leaves the rest with the urban middle class and upper classes, and then the cruceños and beñanos, who are not enough to as a counterweight to Morales. And so Mas has played it very, very well, I think, in an electoral strategy as well, and just being able to work both in ethnicity and region that works in their favor, and the opposition hasn't been able to crack that, if you will.
To respond to Rob Albro's question, I'm in total agreement with you. I think we do need to kind of think beyond these kind of, you know, schematic top-down ways. I think that the 1990s were, exactly as you say, a case of unintended consequences, where the MAS, among others, was able to really take advantage of these new spaces to create new alternatives for it. So I think you're totally right. A nice example in Ecuador, in Rudy Colorado Mansfeld's new book, he has a nice blurring of the lines between leadership and bases. He talks about the paros in 2006 along the Pana, in around Peguche, Otavalo, and what he says is that there's this idea that the cúpula, the leaders, make their orders, and the people who are, you know, manning the blockades do whatever they say. He says, nada que ver. If you went to like four different paros, you had to negotiate with a 15-year-old who had the rocks there. He says there were all these subsequent negotiations. So it's not this kind of, always when we think kind of top down, it's always more complicated than that. So it's just he has a very nice discussion about how that works. I appreciate Oscar's example too. I think that's exactly the kind of thing I was thinking about. Although I didn't know that, so I'm glad to know about what's going on in Loreto. Pam's question about es más un partido indígena. Quisiera dar la respuesta boliviana que nos enseñó Carlos Toranzo. No. Sí y no. Depende a quién le pregunta. Si le pregunta a la gente en Santa Cruz, obviamente son indígenas de M. O sea, y para otros no son lo suficiente indígena, porque no obedecen la lógica de las comunidades, son más sindicalistas que indígenas. Entonces, yo creo que hay que tener cuidado con fijar esas fronteras que es lo indígena y lo no indígena. Siempre es más ambiguo. Hay espacio para negociar estos términos en la práctica. To get to Kevin's question very briefly about the self-respect question about democracy, I think it's a really important question about democracy and development. And one of the reasons why I like Arjun Appadurai's idea, he writes in the context of Amartya Sen's idea of development as freedom, thinking about development as a set of capacities and capabilities, and what Appadurai argues is one of the important kind of meta capabilities is this idea to have broad horizons, an idea to see beyond your immediate, you know, household and community, that capacity to aspire is what he calls it. And I think that's an under appreciated dimension of governance and about development. So I think that is an integral part of what's going on. Very quickly on Victor Hugo, I think he made the decision to end his campaign, and I think it was a good decision, because I spoke to him not too long ago. He had the opportunity to make alliances with people in the Media Luna, and I think the Media Luna would have loved nothing more than to have an indigenous face. I think to his credit, he decided not to do that. But there is clearly a need for a broader indigenous political leadership, and I think there are important indigenous leaders from the Pueblo Guarani, Conamac. There are different leaders. They just are not occupying the stage in the same way right now. But maybe that'll change.
All right, good questions here. So is the MAS an indigenous party? Well, it depends on how you define an indigenous party. If you define it as an ethnic party, in the way that ethnic parties have traditionally been defined, which is as exclusionary parties based in a single ethnic group, which exclude members of other groups and often practice, you know, typically practice exclusionary rhetoric, et cetera, then no, the MAS is not an ethnic party by that definition of the term. If you define an indigenous party as a party based in the indigenous movement or, having a large proportion or majority of members of a particular who are indigenous, then yes, it certainly was at its at the outset. But I think these distinctions are crucial because I don't think actually that an ethnic party, a truly ethnic party, is viable in Latin America. I think because of mestizaje, among other factors, because of the fluidity of ethnic boundaries, et cetera, that sort of exclusionary rhetoric is just not going to work. Not enough people self-identify as indigenous all of the time and are hostile towards non-indigenous people in order for an ethnic party to succeed on their votes alone. And I think, a clear example of that is the failure of Felipe Quispe and the MIP in Bolivia. Do indigenous voters have someone else to vote for? Yes, clearly they do. They have in the past in Bolivia. They have in Ecuador as well. The issue here is that indigenous people, like anybody else, are going to vote on a whole range of issues, not purely on ethnic issues. They're going to vote strategically. So if you're voting for president, you probably don't want to waste your vote on a candidate who's not going to win or doesn't have a chance of winning. They'll vote on a whole range of other social and economic issues. And one of the issues, I've done a lot of voting analysis using survey data of the vote for the MAS in Bolivia, vote for various presidential candidates in Peru and Ecuador. And one thing that we see, yes, people of indigenous descent, indigenous language speakers, are much more likely to vote for the MAS, to vote for Pachakutik, to vote for Ollantumala or Alejandro Toledo in Peru, even controlling for a whole range of other factors, okay? So ethnicity does matter, or ethnic background does matter. And by the way, speaking indigenous language actually matters a lot more than how you self-identify, okay? And that's partly because these people, the MAS is appealing, it's descriptive representation to a large group. People say, I like Evo Morales because he looks like me, or I like Alejandro Toledo because he looks like me, because we have something in common. It's not so much because, we think they're indigenous leaders and they're going to go out and, it's not because they necessarily support ethno-nationalist appeals, okay? What I find, however, is that even controlling for ethnicity or for ethnic background, for ethnic self-identification, there's a whole series of other variables that matter. Okay, having anti-establishment views plays a big role. Being anti-neoliberal, being against, being supportive of nationalization of the gas industry, for example, makes a big difference in Bolivia. Being more on the left ideologically makes a difference. So there's a whole series of other variables that matter. And I've argued in a number of journal articles and in the book that I'm working on that these candidates have been successful by making ethno-populist appeals. So some of it is ethnic, yes, but a large proportion of their constituency are traditional populist constituencies. anti-establishment voters, nationalist voters, people who don't like neoliberal policies, personalist voters as well, people who like Evo or who like Obama or who like Toledo. Beyond their platforms, etc. And then there's a degree of sort of, traditional sort of class voting in there as well. The problem with Victor Hugo Cárdenas, I think, is he was never the populist in the sense that Evo had, in the sense that Lucio Gutierrez was, or in the sense that Ollantumala was in Peru. And so I think that sort of ethnic and populist combination is key, not just for winning white and mestizo voters, it is important with them, but also for winning indigenous voters, because they, like anybody else, vote on a whole range of different issues.
Well, thank you very much. On that note, we'll keep our eye out for the ethno-populists and see how things go. We have the Bolivian election coming up on Sunday. That will be very interesting. On behalf of all of my colleagues in the Americas program, I would like to thank very much this very distinguished panel and all of the distinguished panelists and all of you, ladies and gentlemen, for having come. I go to a lot of events, and not just because this is one that I've been involved in organizing, but I have really had a good time and learned a whole lot. And I wish all events were as enjoyable as this one. And the reason for that is our distinguished panelists and the good questions we've gotten from our audience. And so thank you all very much, and have a lovely afternoon.